Hey, folks, this is Mark Maron from the podcast WTF. And really, why are you listening to Mr. Media Radio?
The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to stand-up comedian, comedy journalist, and Sirius XM radio host, Jeffrey Gurian. He's just published Make 'Em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the Greatest Comedy Club of All Time. The book was co-authored with Richie Tinkin, the public face and co-founder of the legendary Manhattan Night Spot. Stick around. You may not know Jeffrey Gurian, but it seems like every comic from the last 30-plus years does, and that's what matters here. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, brought to you by Amazon.com, Audible.com, and 1-800-DIAL-DJs. Please stop by the website, MrMedia.com, click on our advertisers, support the show. And remember, there's more than 1,000 interviews available at MrMedia.com. We've been doing this since February 2007. Hope you'll find something you like. And thanks for listening. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of people who passed Lucien Hold's audition and still break into a cold sweat thinking about how stressful it was in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. There are a lot of legendary comedy clubs in America, and they come with equally colorful founders. Bud Friedman and the Improv, Mitzi Shore and the Comedy Store, Rick Newman and Catch a Rising Star, Caroline Hirsch and Caroline's on Broadway, and Richie Tinkin and the Comic Strip. They all have their own crop of talented stand-up comedians devoted to one over the other, and one of them, the Comic Strip, now has a book devoted to lionizing its greatness. In Make 'Em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, the Greatest Comedy Club of All Time, comedian, comedy journalist, and SiriusXM host of Comedy Matters, Jeffrey Gurian, and Comic Strip co-founder Richie Tinkin interviewed dozens of comedians about their experiences and memories of the long-running club. Some, such as Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock, are reverent about the joint. Others, okay, just Gilbert Gottfried, is kind of a jerk about the place. But he's Gilbert Gottfried, so I'm not sure what else I expected. Now, the only voice noticeably missing from the oral history is Eddie Murphy, who got his start at the Comic Strip and was managed for many years by Tinkin. The issue isn't addressed, but it seems likely there are still some rough feelings simmering beneath the surface. But even without Murphy, Make 'Em Laugh is packed from start to finish with laughs, history, and more than a few nervous moments, usually recalled by the comedians in regard to their effort to be passed by the club's late manager, Lucien Hold. If you love comedy and enjoy the rare moments when comics such as Lisa Lampanelli, Ray Romano, George Wallace, Billy Crystal, Jackie the Joke Man Martling from The Howard Stern Show, Susie Essman from Curb Your Enthusiasm, The Daily Show's Lewis Black, and SNL's Jim Brewer take off the mask and talk about things that really matter, you'll enjoy reading Make 'Em Laugh. Now, joining me today to talk about his book is co-author Jeffrey Gurian. Gurian is a man of many hats, including comedian and host of Comedy Matters on SiriusXM. He's also a regular every Monday with SiriusXM's Ron and Fez, talking about the world of comedy and bringing along special guests. Ron and Fez, by the way, I would have to point out, got their start right here in St. Petersburg, Florida. No shit. Jeffrey Gurian, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Great.
Oh, see, now you're back on the screen. Somehow something was covering you, but now I see you perfectly.
Oh.
That's great.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I am here.
Well, that was a great introduction. Now I have to try and live up to that. That was very good.
All the pressure is off me and onto you, my friend.
Exactly. Just the way we want it.
There you go.
So, but I have an issue with two things.
Okay, go ahead.
One, Gilbert wasn't being a jerk. He was being Gilbert. You know, Gilbert is like, to me, it was one of the most wonderful interviews because he insisted that he had never been to the comic strip. Now, if you know, first of all, if you know Gilbert, then you know, like, he was the only one that we had to pick up at his house to make sure that he got there. Because with Gilbert, you can never be too sure, you know. And so you don't want to leave any stone unturned. He also has a reputation for being thrifty, right? So,
right.
To use a kind word, you know, or some people might say cheap, but we'll say thrifty. And so he insisted that we took him to lunch. So he picked a place in Manhattan, the noisiest place that you could pick in the meatpacking district, the hippest area. It was a place called Pastis. And the place was packed, so noisy, not exactly the place where you would go to do an interview. Mm-hmm. And Richie Tinkin was paying for lunch and paying for parking in Manhattan, in that area. It's like $40 an hour to park, you know. And so we sit down with Gilbert, and the entire time he insists he had never been at the club, that he just came for lunch. And he did say, he said he heard the club had good electricity, and that they had like one chair, and the comedians would take turns sitting in the chair. And then, you know, it was great for me because Gilbert has always been my favorite comedian. So I had a chance to riff back and forth with him, you know, and I said, I heard they had good dessert. And he, oh, yes, the comedians would stop by for dessert. And I said, I heard you stood outside the place before it was built. He said, yes, I knew where the stage was going to be, and I stood outside envisioning the stage. You know? But we couldn't get him to say he had ever been there. And Tinkin was nauseous. He was throwing up because he's paying for this whole thing. And so it was a perfect Gilbert interview. It was a perfect. So he wasn't a jerk. He was just being Gilbert.
Well, I'll meet you halfway on that. He was being Gilbert. I mean, I've heard Gilbert interviewed, particularly over the years on Stern's show, and you get a real taste of Gilbert at length there, both doing his jokes, but also because Stern will not let him get by just, you know, not making comment. But it when it's for print, as this was for your book, it doesn't quite translate to the performance that maybe Gilbert was thinking it was. It just came off a little jerky in the midst of this book that's, you know, kind of tribute and you know, people are just looking for actual stories.
Well, I'm sorry, that's an interesting point because you as the reader interpret it in a whole different way as me as the writer, knowing him for so many years. Mm. And I'm holding my ear like they did in the old days when you were on TV because my earphones keep coming out. I should probably wear the ones like you have, but it messes up my hair and I can't do that. But
nothing shall come between you and the hair.
And the hair, right? Even on Ron and Fez, they don't make me wear headphones. It's great. You know, I don't have to do that because that makes me nervous, you know. But it's interesting because Gilbert's interview to me was perfect. But to a reader, I could understand where you might think that it was, you know, jerky. I heard him with David Steinberg when he did a real interview. And I actually saw Gilbert recently. And I told him, I said, I can't believe that you were actually you with David Steinberg, you know. He actually answered the questions, like, in a reasonable human manner, which is very rare for Gilbert. And the other thing is, it's Comedy Matters Radio on Sirius XM with Ron and Fez. So what I do is I bring on special guests every week, guests that are friends of mine in the comedy world. When they moved from the Opie and Anthony channel to Raw Dog in January, they're on Raw Dog Channel 99 on Sirius XM, mm-hmm. and they brought me on with them as a regular. We had done the show many times, and we got along really well, and the energy was cool. And so I started bringing on guests, and I kicked it off with Colin Quinn, and then Artie Lang, and Russell Peters, and Susie Essman, and Paul Provenza. And then I bring on actors, too, that are funny, Danny Aiello and Steve Sciarippa. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's not only comedians, but it's mostly. And then I bring on the young up-and-comers, too, like Mike Kaplan and Chris DiStefano from MTV and Andrew Schultz, who's like, he's on four shows on MTV right now. Hmm. So I bring on a range, like young and older comics, because fortunately I'm connected to all of them. And so it's fun for me and it's fun for them. And everybody loves Ron and Fez.
Absolutely, yeah. We go back a long ways, as we've discussed. Well,
yes.
Let me ask you this. So, I imagine that you have been, for a lot of reasons, to a lot of comedy clubs. And be honest with me, Jeffrey, they're all the same, right? I mean, low ceilings, the lingering smell of old cigarettes, 2-drink minimum of watered-down drinks, skanky waitresses. What makes the comic strip so special?
Well, first of all, it's still there. So that makes it very special
okay.
because, you know, the Improv opened in 63. Bud Friedman, the genius, there had never been a comedy club before. And Bud actually opened it as a coffee shop. It wasn't supposed to be a comedy club. And he'd have singers and Broadway stars come, and comedians would be mixed in. But it took about 2 years. Bud told me, and he's in this book, because I wanted to talk to all the players at the time. Rick Newman is in the book, you know. Bud told me that he had no intention of opening a comedy club. It was supposed to be, you know, all kinds of entertainers. But after a couple of years, he realized that most of the people were coming to see comedians. And then he turned it into the world's first comedy club, strictly a comedy club. Before that, comics always perform, but they perform in nightclubs and different venues, you know. It wasn't until the end of 72 that Rick Newman opened Catch a Rising Star. So the Improv closed in New York a long time ago. It's out in L.A. Catch a Rising Star is a franchise that closed a long time ago. The only one that's still open from those days is the comic strip, which opened on June 1st of 1976. It was the third big club. It opened right near Catch. So Rick and Richie used to send comics to each other. Rather than look at each other as competition, they became friends, which was very cool mm-hmm. because it didn't have to go down that way. And one of the exciting things in the book was that when I brought Rick Newman in, Richie got a chance to tell him in person that Rick had been his idol and his inspiration. Mm. And I got a great photo of these two white-haired icons in comedy hugging each other. And it was really very cool because most guys don't tell each other things like that, unfortunately. But when, you know, Catch a Rising Star was so popular, Richie had been a bar owner in the Bronx. He didn't know anything about the entertainment business. They had some musical groups in there, but he wasn't really in entertainment. And he had a bartender named Tony D'Andrea who did impressions. And when Catch opened, it created a lot of excitement in the city, and everybody wanted to perform there. Monday night was audition night. Monday night in the Bronx was dead. If you had three people at the bar, you were doing well. So Richie felt it was safe to go see Tony perform on a Monday night. So he brought 14 people with him. And they go down to Catch, and the place is packed, and he's astonished. It's Monday night. There's literally lines around the block of people waiting to get in. So they go in, and it's a hard-drinking crowd. Richie's friends, you know, we're all pounding down the drinks. And Tony's not going on stage. And it's going on and on. It's getting till midnight. And Richie's like, when are you going up? So he's like, go ask the owner when you're going up. And he went to ask the owner. And he says, I got 14 people here to see me. And Rick's like, listen, customers I don't need. I don't care about how many people you got. You'll go up when we're ready for you to go up, right? Well, Richie never heard anything like that in his life. So he was very impressed. And he started coming down every night. Tony finally went on, did well, but it gave Richie the inspiration. He started coming down every night, and he sees the place is packed every single night. So he thinks to himself, hey, there's probably room for another club. Now, he had a partner who also knew nothing about show business. So they realized they needed somebody in the business to guide them. And somebody turned them on to this entertainment lawyer named Bob Wax. They made an appointment to meet with Wax, and the story in the book that Richie told me was that on their way to meet Wax for the first time, he and his partner John are driving down 2nd Avenue in a taxi. And John says to Richie, where are we going to find a place like this? And Richie looks out the window and sees this closed bar, and he goes, right there. And the taxi pulls over, and they go over to this bar. I think it was called the Shannon Bar or something like that. And it's boarded up. It's closed up. There's a sign where the landlord is right around the corner. Richie goes and gets the guy. They look inside, and it looks perfect. Richie was looking for a place that already had plumbing. That was the big thing to him. He didn't want to have to put in plumbing because he knew from owning bars that that was very important. So the place had plumbing. It was great. They go to Bob Wax's office, and Wax says, look, this sounds like a great idea, but where are we going to find a place like that? Richie's like, we just found one on the way here. And that was how the comic strip started. And what was weird about it is they gave $15,000 for construction. That was all the money that Richie had in those days. And the guy who they gave it to stole all the money and split. The day he was supposed to come to start construction, nobody showed up. The next day, nobody showed up. The next day, nobody showed up. Richie was flipping out. The guy left town. Nobody could find the guy. So he went to the landlord to try to break his lease. And the landlord's like, let me go over to the space with you and see. He goes, what do you need to have done here? And well, they wanted to break through. They wanted to break into the backyard and extend it. Turns out the landlord is an architect and saved the day by building the club for Richie. Gives him a number. He goes, call the two masons, two plumbers. It was like the Noah's Ark of workmen, you know? Two of everything. Call them in, bring them in. And Richie had friends in construction, too, because he's not Jewish. And so when you're not Jewish, you have plenty of friends in construction. And so they all came in, and the club got built. And on June 1st of 1976, it opened. And on June 17th, Jerry Seinfeld walked into audition. And in those days, they would make you fill out a form when you came into audition, and they would rate you as to how good you were. So we have that form. It's still on the wall of the club, and it's in the book, Make 'em Laugh. Mm-hmm. And they rated him good. They said that Jerry Seinfeld was good, and they wrote, definitely invite back on Monday. So next week. And he started performing there, and he was there for the first 4 years of his career until he left for L.A. in 1980. That was his home club.
I will support that assessment. Jerry Seinfeld is good.
He definitely is good. And I think he's proven that. Whatever happened to him?
Yeah, where did that guy go anyway?
No one ever heard. Whatever happened to him?
Such a nice boy.
Unbelievable. Yeah, and so his inner crew was, you know, Paul Reiser, George Wallace, who I was just with in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival last week. George and Jerry were roommates. And, you know, Paul and Jerry got very close.
And I want to add, I mean, this was. I'm glad you brought this up. This was a really interesting bit of trivia for me, that George Wallace and Jerry Seinfeld were roommates, not just for like a month, but they shared a place for 11 years.
Years.
And then
many years.
When Jerry ultimately thought it was time to move on, Paul Provenza moved in, and he and George Wallace were roommates for
exactly.
some time. I mean, it's,
exactly. Isn't
you know,
that
it
interesting?
It really explains a lot about relationships in the business.
You don't picture that. And it's funny because the first three interviews that I did, you know, I got the idea for the book in 2008. I was at the club one afternoon with Gilbert Gottfried, the same Gilbert Gottfried that we were talking about earlier, believe it or not, that same person. And we were there with, we were coaching, what's her name? I got to look at the picture in the book. She's so well known. We were coaching this news personality on how to do stand-up comedy.
Ann Curry, wasn't it?
Ann Curry, yes, thank you.
I read the book,
You read the book. You read the book, right. It was Ann Curry. And I looked at the pictures on the wall, and I had been there for so many years, but for some reason that day it just struck me, and I said to Richie, you should really do a book on this club. There's nothing like it ever. There's nothing has been. So many people started here. And he said, well, let's talk about it. And he came to my house to meet with me about it, and he said, you have more pictures on your wall than I have at the club. He goes, this is amazing. He goes, I think you might be the guy to do the book. And that's how it started. So that summer, I went up to Montreal, and my first three interviews were George Wallace, Larry Miller, and Paul Provenza. They were all up there performing at the Just for Laughs Festival, which for your viewers is the biggest comedy festival in the world. They just celebrated their 32nd year, and I was up there. And it's amazing. I go every year to shoot interviews for my channel, for Comedy Matters TV, and this year also for Sirius XM with Ron and Fez. So everybody I interview says, shout out to Comedy Matters and shout out to Sirius XM. And I got about 30 interviews while I was up there. But it was George and Paul that were in that group of my first three interviews. And it's so interesting that they were roommates.
Well, and George Wallace is an interesting guy because he's had this enduring career. He's always been he's always drawn very well in the clubs, but he hasn't had that breakthrough TV moment like Seinfeld has had as other people. But it was interesting in the book to learn a little more. I'd like to read a George Wallace book at this point. But it was interesting to read about how he came to stand up. He was already an advertising exec, and he was well to do. He was doing fine, and he
George made
to do
money.
Well.
George made money all the time. He always did well. Even when he went out to L.A., he still, while he was waiting for his career to kick in, he was working in advertising, making a lot of money. He always drove a fancy car. Matter of fact, Jerry drove out with him when he went to L.A. George was the guy who sold bus advertising to the comic strip before they actually opened. Mm-hmm. Great story, because it was still under construction. George knocks on the door. Richie and Bob are there. And he tells them that he wants to sell them advertising. On the back of every bus going up 1st and 2nd Avenue, it should say, Eat, Drink, and Laugh at the Comic Strip. That was going to be the original name of our book, but the publisher wanted to change it. So it's hard to get a book deal, so you do whatever the publisher wants. So
sure.
We made it, make them laugh. But a movie just came out that I co-produced, that Richie co-produced with a company called Letterbox Pictures. It just premiered in Montreal at the Just for Laughs Festival called Eat, Drink, and Laugh, and it's an offshoot of this book, a documentary of the history of the comic strip. And George Wallace was there. George recently let go of his Las Vegas thing. You know, he was there for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. It was the highest rated 10 p.m. show.
How did your relationship with Richie begin? It seems like you have you go back quite a ways.
Yeah, well, we knew each other from the club because I always went to all the clubs. I was a comedy writer first. I didn't start performing till more recent years. So as a comedy writer, and then I had started Comedy Matters as a blog, as a zine, really, in 1999. So I was always there, and I was really close with Lucian Hold. You know, I actually used to do healing work on him to try to take away the pain. He passed away from scleroderma, which is a very painful disease, and he was losing pieces of his fingertips. And it's a terrible, not that there's any good way to go, but it was a very painful illness that he had. And I used to go by, and we'd sit in this little private office, which used to be the coat room, which is where he used to pass people.
Mm-hmm.
He was a legendary guy. People used to think he owned the club, because when Richie was with Eddie, he spent most of his time in L.A., and he trained Lucian to really run the club. So he did that for 25 years. So I was always very close to Lucian and to the club itself. I mean, I was at every club. So Richie and I knew each other, but not as well as we came to know each other through this project, you know. And he's just a really interesting guy. He's the first guy to create a schedule for comedians. That's what made the comic strip so different. You had asked me earlier, what made this club special? One of the things was, you know, at the other clubs, comics would sit around for hours waiting to go on stage with absolutely no guarantee that they would ever get on that night. Because if somebody walked in like David Brenner or Robert Klein or maybe Woody Allen in those days, anybody that was well known, the lesser known comics would get bumped and they'd have to sit there and wait. And the comic strip was the first club to start an actual schedule. They give you a time. And God forbid you weren't there at that time. Lucian was like, you would never work there again, you know.
One of the comics has a story about that, doesn't he? That he had two. He was doing two shows there one night, and for the second, between the end of the first show and the start of the second show, he met a girl and he slipped off to some other comic's apartment, and he missed his second gig.
The second show, and when he showed up, Lucian wanted the details, and he had to tell him that the girl had a seizure. That was the only thing he could think of, that the girl had a seizure. And Lucian, without a hesitation, said, petite mal or grand mal? He wanted to know the details, because you couldn't get anything past Lucian.
Right.
You know? And the interesting thing about Lucian is that he didn't need another person to have a conversation. He would talk. You know, there were times when he would strike up a conversation with me. He was like something out of an 18th century romance novel. You expected him to be wearing a cloak and smoking like one of those curved Sherlock Holmes pipes. And he would, I can't do impressions, but every comedian that I interviewed had a Lucian impression. Joe Bolster was the guy that happened to, by the way, and he did a great impression. A lot of guys did, but he was an amazing guy. And he would just ask you a question, and then he would look away, and he'd look into the air, and he would just continue talking for like an hour. You could actually leave and come back, and he would still be in the conversation, not even noticing that you left.
Right. I think somebody in the book says, too, that he would never start a conversation, but if you started, he would just go on and just take that as his cue to just go on and on and on and on and on.
Susie Essman told me the comics had a little signal. They would tap each other and say, somebody needs you inside. They would rescue each other. It was like a tag team thing, because his conversations could really go on so long. You know, he'd sit on the end of your bed while you're trying to go to sleep, and just it was never ending.
And,
but a fascinating individual.
And Jeffrey, for now, I had the good fortune in probably the mid to late 80s. My wife and I went up to New York a couple times, and we always like to go to the comedy clubs. We went to the Comic Strip once. We went to the Comedy Cellar, I think. I'm pretty sure.
Oh, the Comedy Cellar is still going strong.
Yep.
That's been there about 30 years,
That's what I thought. And that
Noam Dworman opened that now. His son, Manny Dworman, now his son Noam Dworman runs it. Great.
But
all the big stars love going there.
For people who love comedy but may have never gotten to Manhattan and may not have been inside, can you kind of, you know, give us a visual on what's it like to actually be in the Comic Strip?
Yeah, it's a nice-looking club. It's not one of those clubs where you're so packed in that there's no room. It's got a large showroom. There's a big bar area in the front. And they do a comedy tour. And, like, once a month I go in there and I greet the people who are on this comedy tour. A lot of tourists like to come to New York and see comedy sites.
Mm-hmm.
So I go there and we do a little book presentation because a lot of people are fascinated to see this club where all these people started, you know. And then there's a showroom that holds about 210 people. There's a higher up space, like an alcove kind of thing, a loge. I don't know how to describe it, but it's a really nice setup. It's not where you're packed in so that you can't breathe. There's tables, you can order food, and they have TVs around so that you can, like, closed circuit TVs so that you can see what's going on, you know? And it's great, and there's a great lineup. It's like a lot of comics, you know, guest comics come in. People like Chris Rock, if he's in town, will come by. George Wallace, when he was in town, Colin Quinn will drop in, you know. And then there are young guys who are filming stuff there. Mike Birbiglia came in when he was doing his one-man show. And, there's a young guy who's taping a special there in a week or two. And I'm blanking on his name, but when it comes to me, even if it's after the show, I will call you.
Okay, that would
be good.
You
know. But people come by all the time, so it's a very active kind of club.
And as you interviewed all these comedians for the book, did it strike you that there was anything that these people who've been so loyal and have such involvement with the comic strip, was there anything that they had in common? Was there anything that kind of drew this group together as opposed to, you know, a group that was loyal to, say, the Comedy Store in L.A., for example, in Mitzi?
Yeah, interestingly enough, and that is an interesting question, comedy is a very solo business. You're on stage alone. You write alone, basically. You know, once in a while, I mean, people do improv in groups. But comedy, per se, is very alone. You're by yourself, you know. You're going on stage in front of strangers trying to convince them that what you think is funny is actually funny. But there was a camaraderie at the Comic Strip, especially in the early days, because there were very few clubs. Now there's probably 18 clubs in Manhattan where you can go to. But in those days, the comics banded together. And Richie, he was described as a nurturing force. When Alan Combs came to do his interview for the book, and I did most of them at the club.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones that weren't were the first three in Montreal, and I went out to L.A. to interview Billy Crystal, because if you can get an interview with Billy Crystal, you go wherever he is. Yeah, I'm not going to wait till he comes to New York, you know? I flew out to L.A., and I was taping Kroll Show on Comedy Central. Nick Kroll has an amazing show on Comedy Central, and I've been a guest playing myself. I've been on there about three times, with him and John Mulaney in this Too Much Tuna sketch, and then with Amy Poehler and Katy Perry and the last episode of the second season. So I was out there doing that, and I went to see Billy, who gave me great stories, and it was a phenomenal experience. But everybody else came into the club.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Rock did and Jerry Seinfeld, and it was fun having them there because being in those surroundings reminded them of things that they might not have thought of had they not been there.
Well, and
you know,
that's actually
memories.
That's what I was going to ask you next, actually, was were there stories, and I gather that Richie sat in on a lot of the interviews with you when possible.
Yes.
Were there stories that were told that surprised you and or Richie, that things that you hadn't heard before or that he hadn't heard before?
Yes, and one in particular that stood out was Paul Reiser's interview. You know, for over 30 years, they have a New Year's brunch. And nobody remembered how it started. It was Paul Reiser, Jerry Seinfeld, Mark Schiff, Larry Miller.
Carol Leifer?
No, but she's part of that story, believe it or not.
Right.
So that was good.
Okay.
And there was one other guy who passed away, Michael Caine, who was part of their original group. A lot of people have never heard of him. He was a young comic, and he passed away. He was actually going on the audition for Diner when Paul Reiser got the part.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Reiser was going out shopping for underwear and socks and had no interest at all, but he was accompanying Michael Caine on this audition. And when the director came out and saw Paul, he goes, "Are you next?" And Paul's like, "I'm here. I'm just going to buy underwear and socks. I'm just here to support, you know?"
Right.
And the guy's like, "Well, come back tomorrow with your headshot because I have a part that you might be right for." And he got the part of Modell. I don't know if that created friction with Michael Caine because he didn't get the part, but Paul did, you know. And I don't even know if he got the underwear and socks, but he wound up with a part in Diner, which really kick-started his career. And so Paul told this story that he and Jerry hadn't really been close. When Paul came to the club, he had been dating Cara Leifer. He said, and the next thing he knew, Jerry Seinfeld was dating Cara Leifer. And he's not sure how that happened. Richie said everybody knew but Paul. So there was this awkwardness between them. And the night before New Year's Eve, I think of 1977, Paul walked over to Jerry and stuck his hand out to shake hands. And he said, "Let's put this Carol thing behind us." And they shook hands, and the next day, that's when they started their brunch. They became like immediate friends after he did that. And Paul said he had never remembered that story until he was sitting there in the club. Mm. And that kind of solved the mystery. And when I told Jerry, Jerry said, "That sounds about right. Let's go with that."
Well, it's interesting, I know it was completely inadvertent, but Cara Leifer shows up in a lot of stories as someone that these different male comics dated over the years. Her name comes up repeatedly, and it's interesting to know now. I mean, of course, later in life, she came out as lesbian. She's got a I don't know if they're married or just a longtime partner. They've got children, and I don't know. It's just,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, yes. It really was. Well, it really was.
It's probably thanks to Jerry. You never to Jerry and Paul. They can add that to their resume.
If the
dating male comedians. You know, and there really weren't many female comedians in those days. It was kind of rare.
So if she was going to date a comedian, it was going to have to be a guy.
A guy, yeah. Exactly. And then she learned her lesson and turned to women.
Male comedians turn Cara Leifer gay. I think that's the headline here.
That should be the headline. How many matters? That'll be my next blog.
All right, so I got to ask you about, and I mentioned it in the introduction, I got to ask you about Eddie Murphy. I mean, he's mentioned prominently. There's no hiding from the fact that he got his start at the club, that he and Richie Tinkin had this relationship for years. Richie was his manager, went out to Hollywood with him for Beverly Hills Cop. But there's no interview with Eddie, and there's no real explanation of what happened to the relationship. And sometimes, you know, in books when this happens, that just makes you, as you read it, you have more questions instead of less questions. So I'll ask you, obviously you're going to not tell me what you can't, you won't tell me anything that you can't, but was there an effort to interview Eddie, or was it just, you know, you just knew that was just not going to happen?
Well, we came very close. From what I understand, Eddie doesn't really like talking about the past. It's one of the things that I was told. We almost did a phone interview with Eddie. Now, I don't like to do phone interviews, and I didn't do any with anyone in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I would have done one with Eddie just to get his perspective. Things went down, I guess. They weren't comfortable for him. Again, people who were very close to him told me that he just doesn't like to discuss his past. And, you know, I didn't go any further than that. We would have loved to have him in the book. Richie has good feelings towards him. He was like a son to Richie. They were together many years, but, you know, it's public knowledge that he fired Richie. Bob stayed on. About a year later, he fired Bob, you know, and then went on to other people to handle his career. But Richie took him through his days on Saturday Night Live, through Beverly Hills Cop, you know. That's how Chris Rock got started. That's why Chris Rock wrote the introduction to the book and has been a friend, because he's very grateful. You know, it was Eddie that discovered Chris at the club in 1986. Eddie was the biggest star in the world
mm-hmm.
at the time. He had done Beverly Hills Cop 1, and people were very excited when he'd come into the club, and they wanted him to come in because it would encourage people to come by. They would think, hey, they could see Eddie Murphy. So he comes in this night, it's a Friday night, the place is packed, and he says to Richie and Lucian, are there any black comics I can see? Now, believe it or not, in those days, there weren't many black comics, as opposed to today, when there are hardly any white comics. But in those days, it was very rare. And the only comic that was there that had pigment was Chris Rock, and he was 19 years old, and he was setting up chairs in exchange for stage time. That was the deal. If he cleaned up the club and set up the chairs, they'd let him go on stage. But he'd go on at 2 in the morning for 6 drunks. There was no audience, and Chris didn't really have any experience. But they didn't want Eddie to leave, so they decided to give Chris a shot and put him on stage. Now, of course, Eddie was Chris's idol, and Chris knew that Eddie was there. So you can only imagine how nervous he must have been. 19 years old, he's getting a chance to perform for his idol the first time in front of a big audience. And they put him up on stage, and he killed it. He totally crushed, and he heard Eddie laughing on the side. Now, according to Chris, he goes, he didn't do that well. He goes, Joe Bolster is funnier than me. But he did well enough that Eddie liked him. So Eddie was waiting for him when he came off stage. And it's a great story because they sit in this window seat in the club, which is still there. And Eddie, he said Eddie was talking to him like he was already going to be a star. His first time on stage, he's telling him he's going to buy a house for his mother and how to handle his money and stuff. And Chris didn't know what to make of it, you know. And they were being protected by his entourage. He had a bodyguard. Eddie had a bodyguard named Fruity at the time who stood by to make sure nobody bothered them. So Eddie gives him his phone number and they leave, you know, and word gets out through the comedy community that Eddie Murphy likes Chris Rock because word spreads quickly about stuff like that. Chris is walking in the street a couple of days later and he runs into a guy named Louis Ferranda who these days runs Caroline's Comedy Club and has for many years. But in those days, he was a bartender at Catch a Rising Star. Very old, dear friend of mine. And so Louis says to him, hey, Chris, I heard that Eddie Murphy likes you, man. He goes, yeah, he gave me his number. And Louis is like, well, did you call him? He's like, nah, man, I'm too nervous to call him. He's like, schmuck, if Eddie Murphy gives you his number, call the guy. So he called him right then and there, and he invited him to come to the movies with him. They went that night with Eddie's whole entourage, and his mother was there, he said, and to show you how long ago it was, he said they went to see Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, and Spike was out in the street selling T-shirts.
Was it Do the Right Thing, or was it She's Gotta Have It?
Maybe She's Gotta Have It. I don't know, but I thought I remembered him saying Do the Right Thing. Anyway, it was so long ago, he said, that Spike was out in the street selling T-shirts. So it was a long time ago. And at that evening, Eddie invited Chris to come to L.A. with him because he was doing reshoots for the movie Golden Child. Chris didn't know anything about show business. He goes, man, I'm from Bed-Stuy. I was never in a hotel. I was never on an airplane. He borrowed clothes from his brothers. There were 7 brothers. So he borrowed clothes so that he could go. And he said, man, he goes, I never even had a shrimp cocktail. My father used to buy 1 shrimp and cut it into 7 pieces. So he goes to L.A., and they put him up in L'Hermitage. And it was during that trip that Eddie created a part for him in Beverly Hills Cop 2. And that's what made his career. And as he was leaving, Richie told me the story. He goes, he'll never forget it. They were on the Paramount lot, and Chris is walking down this long runway, and he turns back, and he goes, hey, Rich. And Rich's like, what's up? He goes, don't forget me, man. And Richie's like, I'll never forget you. And he called New York, and he told Lucian, when Chris Rock comes back, make sure to give him good spots. Put him on 9 or 10 o'clock. Because that was every comic's dream then, to do a 9 o'clock spot at the comic strip. And that's what made Chris's career. So he's been grateful ever since.
I will tell you, and people who are watching this are wondering why I'm looking off screen. I'm looking to see what the movie was for a good reason. Yeah, it was She's Gotta Have It.
And She's Gotta Have It.
And the reason I remembered that is that I was in New York the weekend that opened, and a buddy of mine who I went to high school with in New Jersey met me in New York. I had no idea what we were going to do. He said, come on, we're going to go see a movie. I said, okay. It was the opening Friday, I think, that the movie opened. Maybe it was the second weekend. And he took me to She's Gotta Have It with an all-black audience, and I laughed like I had never – I mean, it was just hysterical. And so when I saw –
Well, I hope you didn't yell out at the screen, because black audiences don't like when you do that.
Yeah.
they want you to be very quiet and subdued in the theater.
Which movies have you been to with a black audience?
So it's just funny that you remember. I'm so glad that you checked that fact.
That's why I remembered it, because I saw that and I went, oh, my God, it was probably around the same time that we saw that. And so I just remembered it because of that.
Did you get a T-shirt?
I did not.
Oh, you did not? Okay.
Did not. No,
there's still
not.
Time, you know.
Yes, there is. Well, listen, it's been great to talk to you about this. I really enjoyed the book. And, folks, listen, you can find Make 'Em Laugh, 35 Years of the Comic Strip, The Greatest Comedy Club of All Time, by Jeffrey Gurian and Richie Tinkin, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com. And folks, you know how this works if you watch the show. If you're looking at this video on MrMedia.com, somewhere below Jeffrey over there, maybe the left, maybe the right, you'll see the cover of the book. Click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon.com. You can order the book there. They will get it to you via drone in 30 minutes or less. Or if that's not possible, you can have it shipped to you, within a day or two. Or you can Jeffrey, the book is available as an ebook, I assume.
It's available on Kindle. That's an ebook, right?
Yep, that's an ebook.
On Kindle, yeah, and in Barnes and Noble, all bookstores, but and Amazon.com usually has the best price.
There you go.
And if I was to look down, could I see it myself?
I don't know. Take a look. What do you see?
I see my shirt. Is that basically? Is that on sale too?
Yes. Yes.
You want my shirt? It comes with the book. For every book you buy, you get a copy of this shirt.
Yeah, and folks, if you want that offer fulfilled, you get in touch with Jeffrey. Speaking of which, Jeffrey, what website do you want people to come and find you at?
Oh well, it would be great if they come to ComedyMattersTV.com, and if they come to my YouTube channel, if they like interviews, I have over 300 interviews with all A-list stars, like Jimmy Fallon, Chelsea Handler, Bob Saget, Adam, Andy Samberg, Jack Black, on and on, everybody in the business. YouTube.com/Gurian News Network, G-U-R-I-A-N, News Network, and you'll see interviews with everybody. You can follow me on Twitter, at Jeffrey Gurian, and on Facebook, Facebook.com/Jeffrey Gurian. You'll see more than you want to know. It's all up there. It's all up there.
And you can see that hair of his everywhere you go.
Yes, everywhere you go. And once you see it, you won't be able to sleep again.
No, yeah.
You'll never forget it.
You'll never be able to unsee Jeffrey Gurian's hair. Jeffrey,
right.
It was a pleasure to get to talk to you and to read the book. And I just wanted to thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was great. I had a lot of fun. I'm going to write another book just so I can come back again.
I hear that a lot. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Hi, this is Buzz Burbank in the Buzz Burbank Newsroom, preparing for you another Buzz Burbank News and Comment. Do you like good stories? Boy, I sure do. I turn over a lot of stones each day to make sure I don't miss the best ones. Sure, some make me angry, and some make me sad, and some make me laugh, and isn't that what makes us human? I'm proud of the fact that I pack more news into my 10 or 15 minutes a day than the evening news does in a half hour. It's a free podcast at BuzzBurbank.com, or you can subscribe free at iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or get it on any RSS device. It's like a newspaper for your head. It's Buzz Burbank News and Comment, another Realm Network presentation. Day mornings right here on the Realm Network.
It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Hi, this is Mark.
And this is Lowell. And if you're fans of Don and Mike, you may know who we are.
Our number one interns. You've met them on the show. They're the guys that ate all the junk, and they were outside with each other holding hands with a sign that said they loved each other wearing the dunce caps.
And what you may not know is that we started out as fans back in their WAVA days.
Hi, Don and Mike. It's Mark and Lowell.
Oh, yeah. Hey, these are two guys that we once actually called them our proteges, didn't we?
And now we have our own show, so we want you to give it a shot. Just check us out at the Realm Network, realmnetwork.com, or you can go to markandlowell.com.
Resistance is futile. It's the Mark and Lowell Show.
Every Tuesday and Thursday evenings right here on the Realm Network. And catch the Poor Premium Show Friday nights.
The preceding presentation was brought to you by the Realm Network.